a thought came to me as I was developing this talk, and that's that I might be a little bit of a disciplinary black sheep to be giving a talk at the Extreme History Project. As my affiliation is noted, I am an earth science graduate student giving a talk to you, history enthusiasts, about geography and maps and place identity and heritage. So that's a hodgepodge of disciplinary kind of anchors, and I'd like to take a few minutes, because this is Geography Awareness Week, to situate my work as a part of geography, and in doing so, talk a little bit about what it is geographers do in our unifying ideas and themes, and hopefully become a little bit less of a black sheep and more of a mainstream sheep in that process. So up here are geographers who I've had great pleasure of working with and playing with through the years, both at K-State and at MSU. And there's a few of you in the room who didn't make it onto the slide. I'm sorry, I like you just as much. But in yellow above their heads are the things that they're interested in. And so we see a really wide range of topics, ranging from the physical, like fluvial erosion rates, or comparing bison impacts on river and systems to cattle impacts, to very sort of humanistically oriented topics, such as place identity or risk perception in the event of fracking in Oklahoma, or even how to teach spatial concepts to students at the elementary school level. And then we've also got more applied topics in the realm of community resiliency and political ecology and who controls land and to what effect, or get into the mapping side of things, cartography and GIS, which is incidentally one of the fastest growing industries in the United States. So that's a wide range of interests, all falling under the purview of geography. And so what unifies these diverse interests? And I would argue that it's geography as a discipline which is concerned with exploring places and place-based processes. So my favorite definition is up top. These are all definitions of geography given by leading geographers who are a bit aged at this point, but they still have some relevant definitions here. My favorite definition is geography is the philosophy of place, as understanding places as a way of viewing the world. And whatever definition suits you best, because there will be differing opinions on that in the room, one thing that really unites geographers is that we all ask kind of the same meta-narrative questions, and that is, where is something? Why is it there? And what does it matter? And so you can boil down all of the previous geographers' topics of interest into that kind of meta-narrative question. And as a cultural and humanistic geographer, I'm really concerned with why do people think about places the way they do, and what factors go into that process? And as a cultural and humanistic geographer, I'm really concerned with two interrelated concepts. And one of them fits into the lecture series here, and that's sense of place. So sense of place is a way of understanding what makes a place unique. And we all experience sense of place in our daily lives, just as we travel around, as we experience places, and so on and so forth. Behind me, and this is a little bit grainy, and I hope it doesn't all look grainy as we go forward, is a leading humanistic geographer, Yifu Tuan, who is a foundational thinker in sense of place and how we acquire a sense of place. And his definition is up there. He says that when we are creating a sense of place, it's born out of our physical experiences and sensory experiences of a particular locale or location, but also the emotional reactions we have towards those locations. And so broadly, a sense of place is this confluence of memory, sensory experiences, and emotional reactions. And they're very personal, the sense of place, and very hard to communicate to other people. And I'd like to think of an example that we can all sort of relate to, which is the difference between a house and a home. So is to someone driving a car down your block. If they pass your house, they might think, that's a pretty building and a well-manicured lawn, or a terribly manicured lawn like my house back in New York. But to you, that building has more than just its material aspect. It also has emotional weight from the events that have happened there, good and bad, that really make that a home for you and give you a sense of who you are and your personal history and what constitutes, A, that being a home versus a house as a place, but also a, at least in my case with my home, it's what makes me Rob and not, say, Nick in the crowd here, because my experiences are intimately linked to that location. And closely related to a sense of place is the idea of place identity. And I'll get into why I use the American West here in a moment. But like sense of place, place identity is one of those concepts that helps us understand what makes a place unique. But place identities are different in how they're understood to be constructed. No man is an island entire of itself, said the poet John Donne. And so the same might be said of places, because places cannot be understood without reference to A, other places, but B, to their social and collective meanings. That is, people collectively, as a group, have understandings about place that those people can more or less agree upon as being sort of the quintessential essence of a particular place. And that these place-based meanings also inform who those people are. Just like a home informs who I am, so the American West might inform the idea of being a Westerner, right? And so the American West, for the West as a region, is laden with rich meanings. Really is a case study example where the placeness of the West becomes an anchor of identity. Even if we dispute the exact boundaries of where it is. I grew up in New York. I thought I was going west when I moved to Kansas. Some Kansans think that they're part of the American West, but you guys might not agree with that. We'll get into this in a little bit. But I also choose the West as an example precisely for that sort of fuzziness, because it highlights the notion of places existing in our imaginations just as much as in its existing in geographical realities. And we all carry around these imaginative geographies that inform who we are. And three things about place identity, I think, should come to light before we move on. First, I'd like to highlight how a sense of time and temporal weightiness plays into our understandings of places. And then I'd like to shed light on how place identities are plural and contested. And finally, illuminate the ways that we come to learn place identities, which will set us up to looking at maps as tools of learning place identity. So the first idea, that idea of place being informed by some sort of temporal dimension, that's really linked to this idea that places are not snapshots in time. They're deepened by an awareness of time passing in that place, as well as sort of dimensions of time that aren't necessarily linked to historical events or the past, but actions and traditions that carry with them some sort of temporal weightiness and bleed into the present, but they still hearken back to a sense of time and tradition and time passing. So this hearkening is kind of fuzzy, right? But it informs my working definition of heritage, which is that of contemporary use of the past broadly, so capturing both a sort of hearkening back to events that had transpired, but also those events transpiring somehow informing present day life. And maybe another case study or illuminating example is relevant here, and that's these are two sports practiced in the American West. And I'll leave you to guess which of them has more sort of temporal weightiness. And spoilers, it's not the snowmobile. It's the sheep herders at the bottom. There's somehow more of a sense of time passing when you consider that activity versus considering snowmobiling in the American West, because there's more sort of tradition tied into that. And before we move from this slide, I'd like to revisit our other points. And that is that The second lesson about places that I want to convey and place identity is that they are inherently plural and oftentimes contested. And this shows up in our news a lot, and it recently has as a hotly debated topic surrounding Confederate monuments. So we've seen Confederate statues as representative of being widely divergent in their meanings to people, right? For some, they represent Southern identity and heritage, and for others, they represent oppression. And as a geographer, I'm very interested in how that tension is negotiated and contested at a particular location, in this case, the statues, and whether or not they rise or fall. There's still flashpoints around which we understand who we are as Americans, right? And what our past is constituted, or how our past is constituted, and who we are today. And so that kind of leads to my final point about place identity, which is setting us up to examining maps, and that is that it doesn't just exist out there or emerge from nothing ex nihilo. Places and their meanings are very much constructed by those who use them. Use the places, that is. And one way we can understand their construction is through this lens of cultural texts. And cultural texts, whether they're a literal text, like a book, or a metaphorical text, like a landscape or a building, are those phenomena that are subtly or not so subtly conveying ideas about the cultures that produce them. And these ideas often translate into values, and we can read values in these cultural texts. And nearly anything can qualify, which is why we're looking at maps, and we will be looking at maps. But nearly anything can qualify as a cultural text, because even in perceiving something, we are giving it value. We can perceive a quote-unquote untrammeled wilderness and give that inherent value because we're judgmental creatures, and we do give things value that have significance to us, right? And so I'd like to enter the map as a cultural text and suggest that it's a cultural text par excellence and that it can be read for very relevant latent meanings. And I'll do that through looking at this 1934 tourist service map of Montana. We'll look at a lot more maps through the series of this talk, so this is just a minor example. But geographers spend a lot of time looking at various cultural texts. We look at landscape, we look at literature, we look at postcard imagery, we look at television and movies and films, same thing. But it's only recently that we've started to look at maps with a critical eye, because geographers often use maps in our daily lives as a tool of analysis. But then, starting in the 1980s, we're saying, wait a minute, maps are projecting a particular view of the world, and they're always presenting a certain agenda. So if we look at this tourist map as an example, we'll zoom in a moment and showcase how there's an agenda here. But we know this idea about maps, that they are inherently given an agenda. And we've seen World War I and World War II propaganda maps, for example. We say, yeah, there's a point of view there. But every map does this, even road maps or geological maps, etc. So if we zoom in on this tourist map, we see here a lot of red signifying hotels and sporting goods shops and restaurants. And we see the roads that let you get there and so on and so forth. And the agenda of this map is pretty clear, especially when you think that the businesses that are listed on the map are those that collaborated with the U.S. Tourist Service to get this map produced, right? So they want you to stop at these places, and the decision-making processes to have these things up on the map is a particular agenda. And to underscore that more, we'll zoom in and look at a different map produced around the same time. I haven't got the precise date, but it's a Conoco oil map. Now, many of the same roads are there, but there's subtle differences in symbology in what's being shown. And I'd like to just highlight these little blue triangles all over the map and suggest that that's the agenda right there. Because we see that in this map, the implicit message is buy Conoco oil and stop at these locations to get yourself oil or gas. And so we've covered some of the conceptual armaments that we'll need for the rest of this talk. And now we have to dig a little bit into the history. And I choose this image of a side view mirror. It's been pointed out to me that this is a side view mirror and not a rear view mirror. Because I feel like we need to set up historical context and look backwards before we engage in our visual interpretations of maps and our critical cartographic eyes and setting those eyes on the map. And a few questions come to mind before we really dig into the maps about how does the Montana Highway Commission and DOT and its predecessor, the Highway Department, get involved with producing tourist maps? And what does this process look like historically on the landscape? And so to do that, we're going to talk about some history lessons here, many of which I've learned through the works of DOT historian John Axelin and his publications, as well as more broad publications about Montana's history as a state more broadly. And we'll start with the Highway Commission, which was founded in March of 1913. It was a three-person job at that point and a $5,000 budget. And the monumental task that they had was to start regulating Montana's road systems, right, and expanding them. And that's a fascinating story, and it's one that I'm learning more about. But as a graduate student, I'm continually learning, and we don't have time to unpack all of that story tonight. But what I want to emphasize here is that from the very get-go, the Montana State Highway Commission was interested in producing maps of Montana. So they were founded in 1913, in March of 1913. And in June of 1913, State Highway Commission calls a meeting amongst county surveyors and commissioners to work towards the creation of a statewide highway map for in-house use. And most counties complied. Everybody sent their surveyors and everybody sent their commissioners. But the 1915 report discussing this says that most counties supplied data, et cetera, except for a few, like Missoula, Dawson, and Ravalli counties, which have refused, quote, refused to furnish the commission with maps as contemplated in the Act of 1913. So there's a little bit of reticence in sharing information about road systems, et cetera. Nonetheless, by 1914, they've got a map. And by 1915, the State Highway Commission report says that we've got a map that's good enough that we want to print about 15,000 copies of it. And I know that these early maps are out there and in circulation. My advisor, Bill Wyckoff, recently found one on eBay from 1914 that was going for $150, so we didn't acquire it. But I'll take one if you've got one kicking around. But one thing that's important to note about these early maps is they're not meant for public consumption. They're more in-house use, so they are reaching the public, and there's a lot of talk in the early State Highway Commission annual reports about developing a map for public consumption directly. And so these maps for public consumption come later during the 1930s, and I kind of have in my head a linkage between these maps being produced for public consumption and the idea of the State Highway Commission being given the task of promoting tourism in Montana, which happens in 1933, and the fact that there's a lot of federal money coming in to build roads. So all of these things kind of make it good for the State Highway Commission to get tourists coming into the state because they can travel around the state more easily. And if that's a possibility, then we might as well facilitate that process by providing maps, providing services geared towards tourism. And by 1935, the process of producing maps and encouraging tourism is well underway. And we see the distribution of the first highway map as well as other programs that really are sponsored by the Highway Department and the State Highway Commission and foster tourism. And we'll look at them first before moving into the maps because they are a means through which these maps are distributed and used. So the first one we're all probably most familiar with in this room is the Highway Sign Program and the Historical Marker Program, which was begun in 1935 by Montana Highway Department engineer Bob Fletcher, Robert Fletcher. Fletcher was a Western history enthusiast. He was a poet. He wrote a lot of pioneer-themed poetry. And he was also a traveler, and he sought to really capitalize on Montana's highway system as a means to promote tourism within the state. So he did so through developing this highway sign program by saying, okay, let's put signs on the side of the road that tell tourists about Montana's past. Let's make them easily visible and enjoyably read. And historians and others, enthusiasts, have taken a look at this process and really documented how it spread across Montana's landscape. Robert Fletcher himself compiled a list of all of these highway signs that he contributed, and the program continues today under Montana DOT historian John Axline and his work, who has also documented this history behind it. So I'm drawing a lot on secondary scholarship here. But a few takeaway points is that there's a deliberate construction of Montana's past here, and it's really one that we'll see reflected in the maps as well, that ties into a pioneer and frontier heritage. So there's colloquial terms on these signs, like dogie, hell raisin, plum peaceful, and a few others that are now no longer in vogue because they are politically incorrect. So there's actually been a re-editing of some of these signs through the years as well. But then there's also additional art in these signs that was carved into them in the crossbeams and in the signs themselves by artist Irvin Shorty Shope, who we'll talk about in a few minutes more in depth. And the takeaway here is that these two guys, Fletcher and Shope, can really be thought of as driving and being the movers and shakers of early Highway Commission and Highway Department ideas about Montanan heritage. And their work is not only the face of Montana tourism promotion in these early years, but they shape it down the line in enduring ways, even after they've left the department. So Fletcher and Shope led efforts to promote tourism in a number of ways in an official capacity. Up here is Shope's memoir of an excerpt from Shope's memoir housed at MHS archives, and it documents some of the things that he was tasked as an artist to do to help promote tourism in the state. In addition to things like pamphlets, which we'll take a moment to look at, next slide, as well as the Highway Sign Program, the Port of Entry Program was a landscape feature for a time that helped welcome tourists into the state, often with friendly advice and questions, and friendly advice and free maps, etc. And there was also a short-lived period of roadside museums, which in the secondary scholarship, they're trying to figure out what's in there, and I would love to figure that out as well. But they were supported by the State Highway Department. And we see that Shope's artwork was really heavily incorporated into the materials distributed by the Highway Department. We'll take a few looks at that and allude to it. One of them is, here's a poster draft that was actually provided by Suzanne Shope. So when she heard I was giving this talk tonight, this is a descendant of Irvin Shope. She passed along an image, and I'm really grateful to have made that connection. So thank you for putting this online. And then there's also other publications. So in 1940 here, we see that Fletcher really drove the publication of Montana in Brief, which was meant to sort of help promote tourism beyond the boundaries of the state. And we see more of it, too. So here we've got cover art from additional materials associated. I've got myself this thing. We've got cover art, right? And an early work here is a historical map produced as a collaboration between Fletcher and Shope, which really, as the title suggests, exhibits frontier and pioneer life and history on Montana's landscapes. And so now we reach the highway maps. It's been a few minutes to get there. And I'd like to, before we move into sort of a chronological exploration of a visual interpretation of these maps, I'd like to point out a few things that showcase what critical cartographers bring to the table when we think about design elements and maps. First, the maps themselves are effectively designed in conveying Montana as their subject, right? Montana is centrally located. The other states around it are not. And design elements are put superimposed upon those other states to draw the eye towards the center of the map, right? But also remind you that this is a product produced by the state of Montana, right? And for a particular purpose. And secondly, I'd like to point out that we're only looking at one side of the map right now. On the other side, there's cover art, there's inset texts, there's inset maps, and all of these things kind of inform our reading and understanding of Montana's past when we investigate them. So the map doesn't just stand alone, it's attached to a whole lot of other stuff, which we'll look at moving forward. And so this is my early forays into visually interpreting these maps, and I need to get into the archives to find more of what my advisor says is behind the curtain of the final product. Right, so that's an ongoing project and one that I'm looking forward to dig into. But in the 1930s up to 41, you really see a strong imprint of Bob Fletcher and Irvin Shope. 42, Shope still provides the cover art, etc., but we'll get to that in a moment. And what we see here is that many of these maps are depicting Montana's rich natural scenery and natural heritage as a selling point, right? And that's understandable. We live in a beautiful state. And looking at the map itself, we see that most of the points of interest are in the western half of the state, the mountainous west, and that they're all associated with what I've sort of categorized as natural landmarks, historical landmarks with a frontier or pioneer era theme, but also a slight sort of nod towards an industrial theme when you think about dams and agricultural science station as points of interest as well. And we'll dig into them in a moment, but I allude to them now because they become more important down the line. Also evident in these early maps is the inclusion of the national parks through both the main map, they're in both, but also through large inset maps on the back cover. I'll use the mouse here to just showcase them. And this is intriguing for a couple of reasons. For one thing, it places the national parks as a square part of Montana, and this is rightfully so in the case of Glacier, right? But interestingly, Yellowstone becomes part and parcel and wrapped up into what it means to be in Montana as well, because they're included, Yellowstone is included on the map. And indeed, when we look at photographs down the line, as photographs become incorporated into the materials of the map, all of those images are from Wyoming and not Montana, but they're depicting Yellowstone. And so this is sort of an appropriation of Yellowstone National Park as a part of Montanan identity. And as we move towards the end of the 1930s and into the 1940s, we begin to see on the map a deepening and more complex understanding of Montanan heritage as you begin to see points of interest focused on Native American sites and fossil sites, so alluding to a more deeper time understanding of what it means to be in Montana. And I've gotten ahead of myself, but just to sort of get in a little more detail here, and I wanted to showcase what the points of interest look at, so I'm squinting over a lot of these things pretty in depth, but there's oftentimes a sort of mountainous Montanan bias when you're looking at points of interest and stuff on the map itself. This is my favorite image, just because it is so visually evocative. And the 1942 map is the last map that has Shope's illustrations on it, because no maps were produced between 1943 and 1947. And besides having a visually stunning cover, which we can read for deeper meaning, and we will, it's significant in understanding Montana's heritage because it makes very explicit the role that industry plays in an idea of what it means to be in Montana. So the points of interest begin to highlight industrial production here and heavy industry and mineral wealth. But rather than the gold and silver of sort of the boom era days, you see instead that the men and materiel of war become associated with the Montanan landscape. And we see that here in the image. For example, stacks, right, processing something. Buttes, head frames. We see Montanan men doing very manly surveying things on the landscape. And all of this alludes to sort of the idea of Montana's value as an industrial hearth of the United States. So it's tying into larger ideas about what it means to be American in addition to what it means to be Montanan. And we'll hop forward to the post-war years. And mapping picks up again in 1948, and it continues into the 1950s. By the way, I forgot to mention, we're going to stop at 1999 because I haven't got all of my analysis together. But as we move into the 1950s, we see major changes in how the maps are presented, right? We see the use of photography, and I, in looking at these photographs, start to see this as an expanded vision of the state because we start to see imagery of the eastern half of the state for the first time. We also see Montana, for a brief period, becoming relational to other places in sort of the international sphere, particularly through this Montana gateway to Alaska inset map, highlighting Montana as a means from getting from one part of the United States to the other through Canada, and Montana as that corridor. And we also see that the industrial theme expands to include explicit visuals and text mentions of other businesses that we associate with Montana life beyond ranching operations or Pioneer Day agriculture. We see the idea of Treasure State becoming inclusive of all the things that Montana produces for the country. And just to kind of showcase that a little bit more, one of the things that I like about a lot of these maps is they include slogans. And in the 1930s, I forgot to add this, but you see a lot of the slogans being the land of shining mountains, whereas as you move forward in time, you see the Treasure State appear more often. Or as we move into the 60s, you see Big Sky Country, which I argue is a slogan that is very inclusive of the state, because no matter what landscape you're standing in, what that landscape looks like, you're under a big sky rather than just in the land of the mountains, that kind of thing. So in the 1960s, we really begin to see a proliferation of outdoor recreational activities that take place in the map imagery, and many of which are family-oriented. And we see several developments related post-1966 to the rise of historic preservation at the national scale. And Montana's historic landscapes are advertised in the text and in the map itself through National Historic Landmarks, through historic districts, etc. And we'll return to this in a moment. And we see the beginnings of, in my mind, sort of a regionalization, which will provide the focus and the second kind of theme of our talk as we move forward. So one of the ways that historic preservation manifests itself is in urban areas, and this is well documented in broader literature, but you see it on the map too, by the inclusion, once again, of inset maps more commonly. They appeared in the past, but they fell out of favor for a time, but you see again sort of Missoula, Butte, other major cities becoming put on the map again, or on the back as insets again. So that's an interesting facet that we'll continue to see more in depth as we move on. And in the 1970s, particularly starting in 74, we see the creation of regionalism in Montana and highlighting diverse regional landscapes through this idea of creating countries and advertising them on the backs of the maps. So Initially, there are those five countries of Montana established, and they've persisted and expanded, and some name shifts have happened, but they still exist for marketing purposes today. I find this to be a really fascinating sort of way of marketing place and highlighting diversity within the state, because each of them become associated with a particular history, particular set of traditions, etc., which gets more in-depth as we move farther or closer to the present, rather. And as an aside, cartographic technologies and conventions are changing. And that use of greater contrasting colors is both a quirk of changing technologies and printing maps, but it also, to me, when I'm reading this, suggests a diverse tapestry on landscape, just sort of underscoring increasing diversity. And in the 1980s to 1990s, I want to also preface this, we're kind of leaping forward and lumping things together a little bit more, and that's because many of these maps are sort of built on a stronger template, if you will, and there's minor changes between, say, 84 and 85, or the cover might change, that sort of thing, but if you read the text and the layout, they're often very similar. But you see an expansion of regionalism by the creation of new countries being added to the map, if you will. And one of the sort of things that I found interesting was there's a much more explicit sort of idea of Montana being more looking inward. And this ties into other movements within the state, as well as fits into national trends of increasing regionalism and localism as being a marketing strategy. But we see that Made in Montana crate being advertised in many of the maps of the 1980s going forward. And gone is really any mention of frontier era histories. Though they are still existing in the photographs and historic sites, they're not necessarily being included in the governor's letter, etc. And in the 1990s, I really see an expansion in what I call right now peak regionalism, simply through design element choices. So again, we don't have major changes in any particular year, but if we can go back to a previous slide, so here in the layout, all of the countries are distinguished, right? But in this one, they're even more distinguished and delineated. In my mind, that creates a heightened sense of internal diversity in the state. In addition, you see the strong return of urban inset maps, including local places, and these become hearths of sort of the countries that they belong to. So you're encouraged to visit Whitefish, etc., when you're in glacier country, right? And so they become sort of nodes of identity with their own rich histories and rich cultures, because some of these, if you zoom in, you see that there are cultural features mapped in the streets themselves. And so I'm going to end it a little bit early here. And before I give thanks to everybody, including you guys again, I'd just like to sort of close with some takeaways about, A, geography, because it is Geography Awareness Week. As geographers, we're really concerned with places and place-based processes. And I'm particularly interested in how people think about places. And oftentimes this translates into visual interpretations of the things that people make and as ways of filtering their world. And maps are a fantastic way to look at that. And one thing that, if you had to leave this room with nothing else, it would be just to recognize that maps are not objective, right? They have a particular message that they want to convey to you that's very carefully crafted. And hopefully I've illuminated some of the possible interpretations of these maps going forward from a sort of, if we're looking at how Montana's past is represented, we can think of it as a more monolithic sort of frontier era, pioneer era landscape to being one that's more inclusive and more diverse. So with that, I'd like to thank again the Extreme History Project for inviting me to talk here tonight. It's been a pleasure, as well as the Museum of the Rockies for the space, and my friends and colleagues, both at MSU and KSU, who listen to a lot of my ramblings. And of course, the guy who listens to a lot more of my ramblings, Dr. William Wyckoff, my advisor, and everyone here tonight. Thank you. And I'd like to open it up.